Chris Gibbons with the Midday Report.
Well, thanks to the Eyewitness News team. More from them as the day unfolds. And don't forget, you too can keep us up to speed in the picture via the SMS lines. They're open right the way through the Midday Report. And that is brought to you by iBurst Business. We start in the tiny farming town of Ventersdorp, west of Johannesburg, where security is high ahead of tomorrow's funeral of murdered AWB leader Eugene Terblanche. Terblanche was killed last weekend, allegedly by two farm workers involved in a wage dispute. Not only will members of his family and AWB supporters be present for the service, but also en route at the moment, members of the world's media moving into Ventersdorp. Eyewitness News, of course, has been there since the start of the week. We're joined now by Stephen Grooters, who'll be watching the events for us. Stephen, good afternoon. Welcome. I gather both police and defence force are there and in numbers.
Yeah, lots of police all over the place. And you know, when you look at the police vans, you can see where they come from. Some are from Potchefstroom, from the little town of Orkney. They brought in police from everywhere. Some of the senior police officers who were in charge of Tuesday's operation outside the court, who did, I think, a fairly good job, they've been here the whole time as well. I think they've been planning for tomorrow. They want nothing to go wrong tomorrow at this funeral. They know emotions are high. They know people are tense.
Are large numbers of AWB supporters arriving? Have you seen any signs of that?
Not yet, Chris. You know, many of the members that do live around here do live on farms, so you don't see them very much in evidence in town. We've been both to the centre of town and through Ching, the township here today, and no real evidence of AWB members in large numbers. One or two people honking their horns as they drive past the Terblanche farm. There's still flowers and things set up there, the old flag in the shape of held up by a cross there. But no real movement on that score. We do expect, and I've just actually got off the phone with the spokesperson for the AWB. He reckons we'll have 5,000 or 6,000 people here tomorrow. He says people are coming from all over the country and some from as far afield as the UK.
Do we know yet, Stephen, what the plans for the funeral are, and indeed if the media will be allowed to attend?
Yeah, to an extent we do. We're expecting this to be held. It's in one of the churches here, the PNK Church. It's going to be last about half an hour, from about 12 o'clock, a normal service is what I've been told. So half an hour, maybe an hour at the max. The media will be allowed there. Then it will move to the Terblanche farm. Now, there's a family burial ground on that farm, a family cemetery. So he's going to be laid to rest there. We're told for the moment that the media will be allowed to watch that proceeding as well. That could possibly change. And then after the funeral, we're told that the new leadership of the AWB will have a meeting, and at that point they might make any intentions clear. But the organisation, in public at least, is saying that it's opposed to any kind of violence.
Could this be one of those events where there are more reporters and camera crews than actual participants?
It's a possibility. I think we will be outnumbered by AWB members. You know, the sort of question that no one's really been able to answer satisfactorily, and I'm talking about the AWB not being able to answer it satisfactorily, is what is your membership at the moment? And then a subsequent question to that would be, what was it before the murder and what is it now? What will it be next week, Monday perhaps? And I think those are questions we don't know the answer to yet, and those really would give us an indication of how seriously to take the AWB as an organization. It would also go a long way to working out what it could be capable of. I get the impression that most people feel not particularly much, but we are operating with very little information.
At the same time, Kasatu has called a mass meeting of farm workers in the area and is also warning about the possibility of some kind of attack.
Yes. Now, this mass meeting is going to be in the community hall in Ching. We've been there today as well. It's about as far as you can get from the church where the funeral will be happening and still stay within the municipal boundaries of Ventersdorp. And I think Kasatu is trying to do two things. One is, they feel they need to have a meeting to discuss this. They need to sort of gauge the temperature of the community. They want farm workers to be there. I think also, sort of reading between the lines, it might be an attempt to actually stave off what happened on Tuesday. You know, the black Ventersdorp residents who came on Tuesday to the court, that was unplanned, that was curious onlookers, one or two people, I think, interested in what was going on. And yet we still had sort of racial tempers flaring, if I can put it like that. I think this is an attempt to draw the hotheads away from the funeral and to keep them in Ching, where there will be this meeting, where they will be addressed by Kasatu leaders, where they will be actually able to explain to their leaders how frustrated they are. And so it could actually be quite a cunning plan.
That is Stephen Grooters of the Eyewitness News team talking to us from Ventersdorp.
The Midday Report with Chris Gibbons.
Well, I mentioned COSATU in the conversation I've just had with Stephen Grotes, but that's only part of the reason they're up next on the Midday Report. We've spent a lot of time discussing the Terre Blanche murder this week, and along the way the subject of white farmers killed has cropped up. A lot of angry SMSs from you about that subject. Indeed, the DA has raised a figure, says that some 3,800 farmers murdered, which I have repeated. But at the same time, we had probably more SMSs saying, and I'm paraphrasing here, you and the rest of the media are always on about white farmers being killed. Why do we never hear about black farm workers? In a country which has a history of often murderous assault by farmers on staff members, that I think is a fair comment. We talked about it with Somadoga Fikeni yesterday, and I promised that we would try and find someone who could give us an overview of that side of the story. And as I thought, COSATU is that organization. It has done a lot of work in this area. And so we're joined from Johannesburg by national spokesperson Patrick Craven. Patrick, good afternoon to you and welcome to the Midday Report. 3,800 farmers murdered since 1994, says the DA. What about farm workers?
Absolutely. Attention has been overwhelmingly on the farmers, and we totally condemn all those murders. But it has to be seen in the context of an environment in which violence, assaults, and even murders is all too prevalent, and the victims are just as likely, in fact, more likely, we would say, although we don't have the equivalent figures, to be farm workers, people living on the farms, who in far too many cases are subjected to a form of employment regime which is virtually unchanged from the days of apartheid, including, unfortunately, the racial element of it, because the majority of the farm owners are still predominantly white and the overwhelming majority of the workers are still black. But we think it's also a class issue, because in some cases even black farm employers can be just as bad in the way in which they treat their workers. It's unfortunately a climate in which labor relations are quite appalling, and the government, through its labor inspectors, is clearly failing in its task. And we would have to be honest and admit that the trade unions are failing, because only somewhere around 3.4% of farm workers are trade union members, which is, of course, one of the reasons why so often when there are problems, they explode into violence, because people become so desperate, they see no other way of responding. And while, of course, we regret that and condemn any violence, it clearly shows the need for the workers to get themselves organized so that they can campaign in a more disciplined way. But we also need government to come on board and to insist that the existing laws which protect workers, specifically farm workers, should be properly enforced, which clearly they are not at the moment.
Are the perpetrators generally prosecuted? Are they being brought to book? I know of one farmer this very week who allegedly beat 7 workers with an iron bar. He has been arrested and will presumably, if he's found guilty, face punishment.
Well, we certainly hope so. And we think that the media attention, which has suddenly been focused on these issues as a result of the Terre Blanche murder, will put more pressure. But there have been a number of cases where there appears to be collusion between farmers, police, the courts, and government officials to enable the perpetrators to get off as lightly as possible. In some cases, not completely to get off. Based on what we regard as pathetic excuses, that the worker that, for instance, they shot was because they mistook them for a baboon or a guinea fowl or some other animal, which clearly, in a normal situation, would not be accepted as a valid defense against a charge of murder.
Patrick, talk to me for a second before I let you go, if you'd be so kind, about what COSATU has planned in Ventersdorp. Public meeting for farm workers, and your Northwest Region statement talks of, and I quote, the planned attack against farm workers, dwellers and communities.
Well, that is clearly a response to some of the wild remarks that were made, which fortunately have been, we hope, retracted by the AWB itself. But clearly there was a climate, and it was felt necessary to protect workers. But also, I think your reporter, Stephen, was correct when he said it's also an attempt to try to do what I was saying earlier, to get the angry farm workers and dwellers more organized so that they can continue to campaign for their interests, but in a more disciplined way, and to try to prevent any more violent responses, which clearly are not the way forward.
Patrick Craven, national spokesperson for COSATU, on the line there from Johannesburg. Patrick, thank you for that insight. Still looking, I have to say, for some concrete numbers about the number of farm workers assaulted, number of farm workers murdered in this context, so that we can compare, as it were, like for like. Maybe the SAPS have numbers, maybe there are other researchers out there who do have concrete facts, but certainly the violence happens, it happens both ways. And it ranges from institutionalized racism on one side, I have no doubt, to casual crime, all the way through to sadistic revenge on the other side. Again, I have no doubt. This is the Midday Report.
The Midday Report with Chris Gibbons.
Quite a few SMSs coming in about the interview with Patrick Craven. Ask again, says one, how many farm workers have been killed? Where is Craven's numbers, says George. Context, what context? Murder is murder. Give us numbers. How many white farmers have murdered black workers? Asks Lynn. Well, I made the point as soon as I had finished talking with Patrick Craven that we did not get the numbers I thought we were going to get, and we will continue to pursue that story. I think it is an important one. A man never far from the headlines, ANC Youth League leader Julius Malema, back home from his recent trip to Zimbabwe, during which it is reported he studied land reform and nationalisation, and also met with President Mugabe. Something of an expert in that area, I'm told. Since his return, he's kept a low profile, but it's been reported he has met with President Zuma, and ANC Secretary-General Gwede Mantashin's been told to cool it over the struggle song Kill the Boer. Well, he earlier gave a news conference in Johannesburg at Luthuli House. Just back from Luthuli House, Eyewitness News reporter Kathy Motlatlana, who's in our Johannesburg studio. Kathy, good afternoon. I gather there was high drama.
Certainly, Chris. A very eventful morning, as one would expect, really, these days when it comes to Julius Malema. The press was really called for him, for the ANC Youth League, rather, to give feedback on their visit to Zimbabwe and the things that they have, as they put it, that they've learned from nationalization and how it would benefit South Africa in the future. And as the press conference was underway, he got into a bit of an argument with one of the reporters that was there. Basically, what Malema was doing was he was explaining why he feels that the imperialists in Zimbabwe that are against the ZANU-PF, he wouldn't come outright to mention who these imperialists are, but he did say that they're people who hold press conferences from Sandton. And so the BBC reporter then just from the crowd interjected and said, but you live in Sandton, what's wrong with holding a press briefing from Sandton? And Malema then got very upset, and he told him that that his behavior would not be tolerated in Luthuli House, basically started shouting at him, became rather aggressive, Chris, and even told security to escort him out of the building.
And how did the BBC's journalist react to that?
Well, at first he tried to be a bit defiant, as in terms of he responded to Malema, but after some time he took a seat back. He sort of leaned back into his chair, and then when the Youth League leader called for security to escort him out of the building, he got out and he packed his bags and he walked out of the building without being escorted by security.
And the rest of the assembled media was happy to accept that, were they?
Well, nobody walked out in solidarity per se, Chris, but there were questions from journalists that remained about why he was kicked out of the building. And at the same time, it came just a few minutes, literally, after he had called the media desperate, and he said that people would do anything to make news, and they're willing to tell all sorts of lies about him. And really, he lambasted the media. He said that everybody's obsessed, and that this obsession that we have with him is driving us crazy, and that it's sick. And so none of the people were really happy about it, but also getting a few giggles from the media contingent that was there. Everybody thought that it was rather funny, because it was it was a very dramatic scene.
All right, now Kathy, what did he in fact have to say about nationalization and land reform in Zimbabwe, and his views whether or not he supports it?
Well, in terms of Zimbabwe, Chris, he says that the ANC Youth League supports President Robert Mugabe as the leader of Zimbabwe. He says they support the ZANU-PF movement and they're willing to do whatever they can to strengthen the Youth League of the ZANU-PF. He says that the land reform in Zimbabwe is a good idea and that it has been benefiting thousands and of ordinary Zimbabweans. He feels that this is a policy which can be applied in South Africa. He says that although there are changes here and there, but they fully support the leadership and the governorship of President Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe.
There you have it. Cathy Motosana of the Eyewitness News team talking to us from our Johannesburg studio. Cathy, thank you for that.
The Midday Report with Chris
Gibbons. Midday Report is 27 past 12 noon. The board of the World Bank meets later on today in Washington to consider ESCOM's application for a $3.75 billion US dollar loan to help fund the Medupi power station. It's a controversial loan opposed by Greens, the United States, maybe Britain, and by Helen Ziller, although not for the same reasons, but it is expected to be approved. ESCOM itself has said there is no plan B, which is an attempt, I suppose, of emotional blackmail, but the threat may not be necessary. As I say, Reuters reporting this morning the loan is expected to pass. Joining us now from Cape Town is Cornelis van der Waal, who is Frost and Sullivan Energy and Power Systems Group Program Manager. He's, as I say, on the line from Cape Town. Cornelis, good afternoon. Welcome. How important is this loan?
Well, it's really crucial at this stage for the continued development of the Medupi power station. Obviously, Eskom cannot finance the power station as it is through its normal cash flows, and therefore it is absolutely critical that it is granted. I think if you take the scenario that South Africa is sitting with a reserve margin close on 10%, with electricity demand increasing at about 1% for every 1.5% economic growth, it will give you an indication that we're going to reach peak demand very, very, very soon. And obviously, with no electricity, there's no economic growth. And in fact, it will lead to substantial economic degradation.
We still come back, though, don't we, to the question of who's using what and at what price. We get the World Bank loan. It's repaid by Eskom's users eventually. Those users look like a cross-section of South Africa. And the benefits accrue to BHP Billiton's shareholders via their aluminium smelters, each one of which uses the same amount of electricity as a medium-sized town. So we're borrowing the money from the World Bank. We're funneling it through Eskom. We're handing it to an Australian mining company.
Yeah, it's a good point. And for that particular reason, obviously, Eskom is currently renegotiating the contract with them. I think we shouldn't comment too prematurely on the outcome of that. But yes, you're absolutely right. It's something that needs to be looked at. And ultimately, what needs to happen is that all consumers should pay a fair price for electricity.
What happens if this loan, by some chance, is not approved?
Yeah, that could be very interesting. There's a couple of options for Eskom and for government. The first one would be for Treasury to finance this and for them to go out into the market and try and secure funding. It's relatively unlikely for that to happen since we know that government is sitting with a budget deficit. Second option would be for Eskom to go into the bond market, but I don't think that there's sufficient appetite for investment of that size, so it's going to be difficult for them to raise it. And potentially they could go to China, and China could finance it, but there's no surety with regards to that.
You think it will go through?
I'm fairly confident that it will go through. I think the rationality with regards to economic growth and development in a developing country, particularly one on the African continent, is very high on the overall agenda. I think that green energy needs to be pushed, but I don't think that we have sufficient infrastructure or resources at this stage to truly displace a base load station. So unfortunately, we are very dependent on this, and I do believe that it will go through.
Cornelis van der Waal of Frost and Sullivan talking to us there from Cape Town. Cornelis, thanks for being with us on the Midday Report.
The Midday Report with Chris Gibbons.
And therefore, for us to get a sneak preview of the latest edition of the Financial Mail, we're joined now by the FM's editor-at-large, Andrew McNulty, who's on the line from Cape Town. Andrew, a very good afternoon to you and welcome. I gather you've written a cover story on business and politics and how business in particular interacts with our politicians.
Yes, it's actually probably a bit broader than business and politics. It tries to look at the role of business in the broad public debate, what the nature of it has been over recent years and what it might and possibly should be. There have been signals from areas of business that they actually want to be more active about it and open. And it's argued that that would be a very good thing, and we try and look a bit at how the business relationship has changed over the years. We have some contributors to this. It's one of them is Muletsi Mbeki, who is a political analyst, and he's deputy chairman of the Institute of International Affairs, and also Michael Spicer, who is the chairman of Business Leadership South Africa. Sorry, he's not chairman, he's chief executive. Business Leadership is an interesting organization. It's not a broad representative body in the sense of business unity, but it is an organization of individuals at CE and chairman level of the 80 biggest companies in South Africa, along with some of the large state-owned enterprises. And they work collectively. And in general, businesses tended to take a very low-profile, formal channel, behind-the-scenes approach in their relationships with government. Business Leadership has now said they want to be more public about it, and they want to focus on specific issues. And really give some attention to particular things like they've talked about a common vision, what success factors there are for different kinds of companies over the next decades. Effective competition and healthcare reform is another one, and energy is another, and promoting and rethinking, relooking at the idea of a non-racial South Africa, including BEE. Muletsi Mbeki strongly welcomes this. He says it can only be good for democracy, and he says that it actually amounts to business in South Africa returning from 15 years of self-imposed isolation, which he says really why it came about because there was a great emphasis on risk management over this time, starting with the period of all the talk about nationalization in the early 1990s. And Muletsi Mbeki argues that a lot of companies have actually focused on internationalization. He puts particular emphasis on the Big Six, or the London Six, as they're often known. The companies have moved their head offices and primary listings to London. It is correct that a lot of companies, although they haven't moved their head offices, have actually internationalized a lot. And even the most familiar companies now, like MTN, MTN really only gets about 24% of its profit from South Africa today. And that there are quite a lot of others that really are growing fast. So the suggestion is that there was a sort of reorientation of the thinking away from South Africa. And that the other thing that Muletsi Mbeki argues is that alongside this, there have been a lot of private deals with the ANC, which was another form of risk management. He suggests that that there will be some reorientation from that, and that there will be more active involvement by business, which of course can only be a good thing.
Andrew, what do you think has prompted the shift in approach, the shift in attitude?
Well, Business Leadership really simply said that what they had been doing in the past, they had recognized and just not been effective enough. Business unity. The other point I should make is that while they said that it hadn't been sufficiently effective, it had to be seen alongside the sort of political background of the Mbeki era, which had tended to be pretty controlling and had created a very much more difficult environment for business. We've only got to look at companies like Sasol and Anglo American and Barlow World and the kind of political pressure which they came under at times when they appeared to have stepped out of line or said something which wasn't approved of. Both Business Leadership and Business Unity, the more broad and representative organization, have said that they have detected a more open approach from the Zuma government, towards just general debate and being more open to ideas.
Andrew McNulty, editor-at-large of the Financial Mail, talking to us there from Cape Town, giving us a preview of this week's cover story in the latest edition of the FM. Every week, Financial Mail gives you cutting-edge insights and in-depth reporting into a wide range of topics, enabling you to make insightful decisions today and make a success of tomorrow. Financial Mail, today's insights, tomorrow's success. And time now for us to take a look at the world of business. Reuters reporting the World Bank set to approve a controversial $3.75 billion US dollar loan to help Eskom develop coal-fired power stations, despite objections from the US and environmental groups. $3 billion of the loan will go towards funding the bulk of the 4,800-megawatt Medupi power station, while the remainder will go towards renewables and energy efficiency projects. Speaking in Washington, World Bank spokesman Peter Stevens says that the bank believes the project is important for South Africa, and they believe that it will be well received by the bank's board. Nonetheless, the United States is expected to withhold support for the loan at the board meeting later on today. From Pumalela Gaming and Leisure, a set of interim figures described by the company as satisfactory in the context of difficult trading conditions and the negative effect of rand strength on international earnings. Pumalela is reporting a 10% rise in pre-tax profit to 62.7 million rand and a 2% increase in attributable earnings to 38.6 million. However, both headline earnings per share and diluted headline earnings per share are down 6% to 47.10 cents. Pumalela is the country's leading tote operator, also operates a tote on the Isle of Man, as well as racetracks at Turfontein and the Vaal. Turning to the markets, the JSE's in downward mode, off about 1% at 28,985. The top 40 also 1% down, 26,013. Gold index down 0.6%. Financial index down 1.4%. Industrials down around about 1%. Resources index down 0.75%. Europeans down by the same sort of amount, perhaps slightly more, and we're looking at the Americans coming online later on. Down about one-third of 1%. Gold is 1146.45. We have platinum, 1694.5. Brent crude, 84.65. Rand dollar, 732. Rand pound, 1112. Rand euro, 975. Dollar against the euro, 133.1. More business with Bruce Whitfield later on this evening, but right now, though, you're with the Midday Report, which is brought to you by iBurst Business.
Chris Gibbons with the Midday Report.
Midday Report it is, heading up towards 12:45 in the South Gauteng High Court. Arguments continue by the defense to have charges against former National Police Commissioner Jackie Salibi dismissed. It is a normal part of most trials. Once the prosecution's stated its case, the defense stands up to contend that they have failed. More often than not, the judge disagrees and orders the trial to continue. However, in this instance, defense advocate Jaap Salier has devoted an unusually long amount of time to his argument, which began as far back as yesterday morning. Mandy Wiener of the Eyewitness News team is watching proceedings. She's with us now from the South Gauteng High Court. Mandy, has advocate Salier finished yet?
He has just in the last half an hour or so that adds up to a day and a half that he spent on his feet arguing about why he believes the prosecution has not made a case against his client, Jackie Salibi. And again today, we saw him carry on with his onslaught against the state's main witness, Glenn Agliotti. He did devote a little bit of time to the other witnesses, such as Diane Muller, who's Agliotti's former fiancé, her father, Martin Flint. But really in his focus today, again, was Glenn Agliotti. And what's at issue here, Chris, is what he calls the concessions that have been made by Agliotti. Now, you may remember during Agliotti's testimony earlier this year and last year, he said that he never bribed Jackie Salibi. He never received anything in return from Jackie Salibi. But we also heard about his definition and his understanding of the word bribery. He maintains that he did give money to Jackie Salibi, but he doesn't think that he got anything in return. So today we heard Jaap Salier saying that the prosecution never asked for Agliotti to be declared a hostile witness, nor have they tried to discredit Agliotti in any way. So that means the court needs to accept these concessions. These concessions need to stand to the benefit of the defense. But we have just heard now from Gerry Nel saying he doesn't understand all this talk about concessions. He doesn't see any concessions because Agliotti's always maintained that he has paid money over to Jackie Salibi, and that's all that's important here.
Now, where do we go from here? The state attempts to rebut the defence's argument, and then we'll wait for a ruling from the judge.
Exactly. So at the moment, we've got Sherry Nell making his argument, and he's answering the claim that this prosecution is based on malicious intent and that it's based on fabrication. And what he's saying is that if the defence is going to prove that a conspiracy did exist in order to protect the Scorpions at the time, then the defence is going to have to show that this conspiracy existed as early as January 2006, that Agliotti agreed to be put into prison for a month, et cetera, that they knew of the UK report, the intelligence report, that they knew of Salibi's spending patterns, that they knew what the Czech subs said. So that's his argument at the moment. We expect him to go on for about another 2 hours or so after lunch, and then the judge will decide if he'll hand out a ruling today, if he'll hand out a ruling tomorrow, or perhaps on Monday.
That's Mandy Wiener of the Eyewitness News team talking to us there from the South Gauteng High Court. Interesting stage in any trial. Normally, as I say, normally a bit of a ceremonial moment. But you never know. You really never know in these things. And we will keep you posted one way or the other via the Eyewitness News team. And this is The Midday Report.
The Midday Report with Chris Gibbons.